This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Curious, Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful in Art History is a brand new book with lots of weird and wildly entertaining stories that haven't been covered on this podcast. Stories like the rise of everybody's favorite painter of the pretty, Claude Monet, and how all those water lilies and haystacks were actually subversive badassery. How some late 19th and early 20th century women may possibly be the first abstract artists. And what do toenail clippings and a chunk of Caroline Kennedy's birthday cake have to do with one of Andy Warhol's most enduring legacies? Art Curious, the book, will be released on September 15, 2020, but you can pre-order now to reserve your copy. Pre-order links are available in the show notes or at our website, artcuriouspodcast.com/book. That's artcuriouspodcast.com/book. This season of the Art Curious podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Anchor Light. Please visit anchorlightraleigh.com to learn all about their artist residency programs, exhibitions, and more. Before I begin this week's show, a few words. Art history, this odd and wonderful world we inhabit on our show, is all about expression, appreciation, and perhaps most of all, interpretation. The protests and frank discussions happening now about systemic racism and police misconduct, sparked by the killing of George Floyd and reinforced by the treatment of protesters by law enforcement, I think can be viewed similarly. Meaning this. Now is a time for expression, including expressions of both rage and hope. Now is the time for appreciation of those emphatic voices who have, for far too long now, remained unheard and unrecognized. But unlike art history, the central tenet of these protests needs no further interpretation. It is clear, and we are clear about it. Black lives matter. And we will remain supportive of this cause until the change that needs to happen happens. And the need for conversations like these also becomes history. To learn more and to find ways to stay involved, visit blacklivesmatter.com. Please note that there is some mention of abuse in this episode, so please take care when listening. Are you an artist? It's a question I get all the time when I mention that I work in an art museum, and especially when I tell people that I am a curator. The answer is no, I'm not an artist, at least not in the traditional I paint landscapes or I make clay pots kind of way. But I understand this question a lot. Because for many, working in an artistic field or an artistic institution makes the most sense if you, yourself, are an artist. When I balk and I tell people that, no, I'm not an artist, but I so appreciate and love the work of so many artists, I often find that a kind-hearted person will tell me, no, you're an artist too, we all are in our own way. And there's something really beautiful about that statement. Just like it's really hard to define exactly what art is, so it is when we try to define who an artist is. Are you an artist if you go to art school? Are you an artist if you work as a designer or a house painter? Are you an artist if you draw in a sketchbook at home for fun? What about if you made an amazing 15,000-page graphic novel building an imaginary world for no one but yourself? Some people think that visual art is dry, boring, lifeless. But the stories behind those paintings, sculptures, drawings, and photographs are weirder, crazier, or more fun than you can imagine. In season 7, we are uncovering the coolest artists that you don't know. And today, we're looking at the life and work of Henry Darger, one of the most fascinating outsider artists of the 20th century. This is the Art Curious Podcast. Exploring the unexpected, the slightly odd, and the strangely wonderful in art history. I'm Jennifer Dassel. Let's start with the basics. Who was Henry Darger? It turns out that this might not be as basic a question as you'd think, and depending on who you ask, you might get a variety of answers. He was a simple person. He was a complex person. He was an artist. He wasn't an artist. He was an oddity. He was an inspiration. So you can see some of the difficulty right off the bat in understanding who Henry Darger was. But we do know at least some facts, which is great because Henry Darger's early life is most likely the key to understanding the man and the maker that he would become. Henry Joseph Darger was born on April 12, 1892 in Chicago, Illinois, to father Henry Darger Sr. and mother Rosa Fullman. Not much is known about his earliest years, except that when Henry was just 4 years old, his mother died of a severe fever and infection after giving birth to Henry's little sister, a girl whose name is unknown to us, and even to Darger himself, because Darger's father, Henry Sr., felt unable to care for both of his children in the wake of his wife's unexpected death. Shortly after baby girl Darger was born, she was given up for adoption, and her brother would never again see her or know her. This loss of his sister primarily and his mother secondarily would be noted as a seminal moment in little Darger's life, a moment that would go on to inspire, perhaps, his magnum opus, all about young, innocent, lost girls. But first, there would be more losses to grieve. Henry Sr. and Henry Jr., by all accounts, got along well. Darger would note that his dad was kind and loving towards him. But in 1900, the year that Henry Darger turned 8 years old, his father fell ill and was moved into a convalescent home for the aged and infirm. Unable to properly care for his son then, Henry Sr. was essentially out of the family picture, and little Henry was transferred to a Catholic orphanage called the Mission of Our Lady of Mercy. And it was within this environment that the signs of trouble in Henry's life began to first manifest themselves. Most accounts of his childhood have implied that Darger was a little strange. Peculiar seems to be the word that comes up most often. And at the same time, though, there was no doubt that young Darger was extremely smart, ahead of the curve in terms of intellect, and better at reading and writing than most other children his age due to his father's support of literacy and learning. But such smarts didn't do much to help Darger ultimately, and instead he found himself on the wrong side of authority at the orphanage. After numerous outbursts, fights with other students, and smart-alecky disagreements with his instructors, Darger was sent for a psychiatric evaluation, after which it was determined that he be institutionalized in Lincoln, Illinois, at the rather frightening-sounding Illinois Asylum for Children with Feeble Minds. Yeesh. Not a whole lot is known about Darger's time at the Illinois Asylum for Children with Feeble Minds, but you can imagine that it probably wasn't super great. Some have extrapolated that the abuses detailed in his writings, physical and sexual abuse, probably stemmed from this particular period. Child labor, too, was part of the deal at the asylum, so add that to the mix. And it's not surprising to note that Darger tried mightily to escape its walls. Later in life, he recounted a distressing capture on his first escape, wherein he was caught by a boy not much older than himself who was riding a horse. To take him back, the boy tied Darger up by his hands and forced him to run, tied to the horse, all the way back to the asylum. Luckily, by the time of his third attempt, Darger managed to escape, walking away at the age of 16 and ending back home in Chicago. Not that there were many people waiting for him upon his return. Just prior to his successful escape from the asylum, Henry Darger received word that his father had died, essentially leaving him alone in the world. Thankfully, he did have one person on whom to rely. His kindly godmother, who connected him, now at 17 years old, to a nearby hospital, a Catholic institution called St. Joseph's. And it was there that Darger was hired as a full-time janitor. It would be the only job he'd hold throughout his life, and he held on to it until he retired in 1963 at the age of 71. That's kind of the gist of his biography in brief. That's the Henry Darger, the custodian, that most people knew of him during his lifetime. But it was what he did in his off hours that makes him of such interest to us today. And that's coming up next, right after this break. Stay with us. There are so many benefits to lifelong learning, and that's why I love The Great Courses Plus. Expand your curious mind, build upon your skills, improve your memory and self-confidence. The list goes on. It was created for the lifelong learner in all of us, and this streaming service provides access to thousands of fascinating, fact-based lectures across almost any topic imaginable. And they're taught by world-leading professors and experts. So you can explore topics like ancient Rome, cooking around the world, and you can even learn things like how to better garden or how to watercolor paint. And with the Great Courses Plus app, it's easy to watch or listen anytime and anywhere. So it's great for families and for people of any age. I recommend checking out this course, Understanding Great Art. This is an art history and art appreciation series that features lessons on understanding things like common symbolism in art, specific techniques, and various time periods while showcasing more than 250 of the world's most famous artworks. So continue your journey as a lifelong learner now and sign up for The Great Courses Plus. As always, they are offering a great deal for my listeners, which includes a free trial of access to their entire library. To start your free trial, sign up today using my special URL. Don't wait. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/art. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/art. By now, you know that I love art, and sometimes it's really nice, especially when I can't see an artwork in person, to have a new way to enjoy art classics. So I wanted to tell you today all about MOVA globes. These are gorgeous rotating globes that are powered by ambient light, and they involve the first of its kind technology that has hidden magnets that provide this a wonderful rotating movement. There are no batteries or messy cords in there, and they are a great gift for somebody who has everything. For me, it's a new way to enjoy art classics like Van Gogh's Starry Night or his Irises. They take these wonderful iconic Van Gogh artworks and they are carefully recreated to transform something that's a flat painting into a three-dimensional piece of art. But it's not just famous art that they've transformed. MOVA globes are also available in over 40 different designs, including world maps, outer space, and of course, famous artworks. Consider MOVA globes today for somebody that you love or as a gift for yourself. Go to www.movaglobes.com/artcurious and use the coupon code ARTCURIOUS for 10% off of your purchase. Again, please visit www.movaglobes.com/artcurious and use ARTCURIOUS for 10% off of your purchase.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hi, I'm Chris Gethard, and I'm very excited to tell you about Beautiful Anonymous, a podcast where I talk to random people on the phone. I tweet out a phone number, thousands of people try to call, talk to one of them, they stay anonymous, I can't hang up, that's all the rules. I never know what's going to happen. We get serious ones. I've talked with meth dealers on their way to prison. I've talked to people who survived mass shootings. Crazy funny ones. I talked to a guy with a goose laugh, somebody who dresses up as a pirate on the weekends. I never know what's going to happen. It's a great show. Subscribe today, Beautiful Anonymous.
Welcome back to Art Curious. When Henry Darger wasn't at work keeping St. Joseph's Hospital spick and span, he was hard at work in his own deeply imaginative, boundless mind. Though ultra-secretive in his everyday life, at home he was expansive, concocting drawings and stories that exist in tens of thousands of pages. He produced over 30,000 pages of content over his lifetime, about all the things so often out of our control, our destinies, battle between good and evil, and the fight for the ones that we love. It all began around 1909 as a means to managing the stories and pictures that filled his head. And his process was fascinating. He experimented with drawing, collage, copying, tracing, and overlay, among other methods of creations, to define the best way to bring his thoughts to life. Placed on cheap butcher paper, these illustrations were then glued together to form large panels to tell any segment of his story, that were then laid out like a storyboard and sometimes reached up to 12 feet tall. As a completely self-taught artist, Darger knew little to nothing about art itself or the techniques and traditions that so many artists followed lovingly. With him, it was all about personal innovation, experimentation with whatever sprang to mind, and he'd try almost anything to see if it would work for him. He took inspiration from little things, clippings of advertisement models or celebrities on which he'd based his characters, like the Coppertone Girl or actress Mary Pickford. He also used plot lines from his own limited experiences, especially while growing up and in the care of the orphanage and the asylum. And, oh boy, did it all add up into something interesting. Ultimately, much of what Darger produced would become one single masterwork that makes up half of his entire artistic output, a 15,000-page illustrated novel that he called In the Realms of the Unreal, with the largest portion of the book, if you want to call it that, subsectioned into what was called The Story of the Vivian Girls in what is known as the Realms of the Unreal of the Glandico-Angelinian War Storm. I know, it's a mouthful. And you can already see that Darger wasn't into editing his titles, just as he wasn't enthused about limiting his page count. But The Vivian Girls, which is how we'll shortcut the title of the main section today, is an incredible and unfettered glimpse into the mind of a man who made art as a way to escape his own terrors and to understand the realities of his own little world. But yeah, 15,000 pages. David Foster Wallace, eat your heart out. Now, In the Realm of the Unreal isn't exactly the easiest work to synopsize, given its length, but also due to its, well, its semi-inscrutability. From what I can tell, the story is about the battle between the evil Glandolinians, who were non-Christian soldiers that tortured children, and the devoted people of the Christian nation known as Abiania. Heading the rebellion are the Vivian Girls, the seven princess daughters of Emperor Robert Vivian, tasked with ending the terrible practice of child slavery that was performed by the Glandolinians. Even the environment is fantastical, with the setting as a planet around which we, on Earth, orbit as a moon. As an alien planet, it is not only mixed with the inhabitants of Abiania, but also with strange hybrid beasts, too. It is an altogether threatening and strange environment through which the Vivian Girls traverse in hopes of defeating their enemies and bringing peace to society. And it doesn't always go well or smoothly. Throughout In the Realm of the Unreal, we see curious compositions that illustrate an array of violence, including violence towards innocent children, many of whom are depicted in states of undress and with hints of mixed gender ideations. And as you'd expect from a story that places a Christian people against a non-Christian people, there are many subtle and not-so-subtle religious references. It is a trip. And it isn't easy to look at, nor easy, again, to describe in a general narrative format. Like the essential battle between good and evil, it is an ongoing conflict, lasting for thousands of pages in panoramic collages and watercolors, expanding for dozens of feet. There are images of torture, of murder, of epic battles and daring misadventures, and at no point is it a foregone conclusion that the Vivian Girls, nor any other do-gooders, will win. In fact, in perhaps the most unexpected element of all, Darger conceived of two separate endings for his masterpiece, one in which the Vivian Girls are, of course, triumphant, and one where they are brutally defeated by the Glandolinians, who go on to rule the land. It's almost like a choose-your-own-adventure, but in a decades-long graphic novel format. Many have questioned the origins of In the Realm of the Unreal, especially homing in on Darger's inspirations for such a strange, dark, and creative magnum opus. For someone who kept to himself so much during his lifetime, it is certainly hard to draw many super direct connections. But there are hints in Darger's own autobiographical writings that point to a couple different formative moments. Naturally, the loss of his unknown sister, the loss of his own parents, and the abuse he appears to have suffered at the hands of both adults and other children while institutionalized may have played a major part in the creation of this huge work. But there's also another potential inspiration. While perusing the newspaper one morning, Darger came across a story and an accompanying illustration in the Chicago Daily News on May 9, 1911. An awful, awful report of the murder of a 5-year-old girl named Elise Parabek, who had disappeared around the corner from her house and whose body was discovered a month later, with the cause of death identified as suffocation. The understandable horror and uproar that accompanied this and many subsequent articles in the Chicago Daily News kept poor little Elise's sad tale in the limelight for weeks, and Darger, furious with the injustice of child murder, kept a growing pile of newspaper clippings about the case to locate Elise's murderer. No one would ever be identified as the perpetrator. When the original May 9 newspaper clipping disappeared from Darger's archives, possibly as part of a robbery of his belongings while at work, the Parabek story galvanized, for the artist, into a true cause, an obsession over which he would toil for decades and 15,000 pages. As if the loss of Parabek in both real and newspaper clipping form could be atoned for in an epic tale of childhood bravery and vigilante justice on the part of none other than a band of 7 young girls. Darger, too, felt a part of this vigilante justice and even identified with the quest to the extent that he wrote himself into the tale of the Vivian girls. In particular, he cast himself in the role of the general of the Christian army of Abiania, a protector and savior of children like the Vivian girls, quick to act if they were in danger and ruthless in his defense of them. Over the years, there has been speculation about the real Darger's relationship with children, especially young girls, given his focus on them in his art and writings. The question that typically springs up is whether or not he had pedophilic tendencies, a question that Darger's sometimes shocking depictions of nude or partially nude children does spring quickly to our contemporary minds. And we really don't know for sure. That being said, researchers, including some Darger biographers, have asserted that the artist's vision of the Vivian girls is rather progressive and powerful, leading them more towards an assumption of his idealistic visions of children as strong and less about his own personal proclivities. Truly, nothing in his outward life, what little we know of it, given his hermit-like tendencies, bears out any such assumption of sexual proclivities towards children. But again, we can't know for sure. Henry Darger passed away on April 13, 1973, only one day after his 81st birthday. On his deathbed, he advised his current landlord to destroy all of his work, never intending it to be seen by the general public. In this way, he reminds me very much of Goya, whose Saturn devouring his son we discussed in a previous episode of Art Curious. Goya's painting was one of a number of murals completed on the walls of his private home. It wasn't intended to be viewed or even enjoyed by anyone but himself. Darger, too, created art only for himself. But his landlord went against Darger's dying wish, and the landlord found significant value in all those manuscripts, sketches, paintings, and clutter in Darger's apartment. Disposing of Darger's items wouldn't be just throwing away junk. It would have been the dismissal of a man's entire body of work, a sincere and innovative reflection of his unique views of the world. Its rights and wrongs, its struggles and pain, its joys and triumphs. And his aim to envision a world of his own making and control, one for truly his own benefit, has been an inspiration to many. Darger's works have inspired numerous poems, books, documentaries, and films, as well as his own artistic style called Dargerism, which is how I ended up learning about his works a few years back, in reading about contemporary artists who have followed in Henry Darger's footsteps. There's even an all-female indie rock band called the Vivian Girls, which is a pretty cool reference too. Darger was an outside artist before the term for an un-art-educated, self-taught individual hit the mainstream, and before outsider art became popular or even cool. His legacy, though, has been an inspiration to so many, a man who created his own incredible art within the four walls of his tiny Chicago apartment for no one but himself. Thank you for listening to the Art Curious podcast. This episode was written, produced, and narrated by me, Jennifer Dassel, with additional writing and research help by Rachel Whitaker. Our theme music is by Alex Davis at alexdavismusic.com. Our logo is by Dave Rainey at daverainedesign.com. And social media help is by Emily Crockett and Caroline Holler. Our audio production services are provided by Kabunki, the silliest name in superb podcasts and video. Let them help you too at kabonki.com. The Art Curious podcast is sponsored primarily by Anchorlight. Anchorlight is a creative space founded with the intent of fostering artists, designers, and craftspeople at varying stages of their development. Home to artist studios, residency opportunities, and exhibition space, Anchorlight encourages mentorship and the cross-pollination of skills among creatives in the Triangle. Please visit anchorlightraleigh.com. The Art Curious podcast is also fiscally sponsored by VAE Raleigh, a 501c3 nonprofit creativity incubator. As always, we are a fully independent podcast, and so we rely not only on ads and sponsorships, but on donations to keep us going. Thank you for anything you can give to support us. You can help our show as well by leaving a 5-star, super happy review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, because believe me, it makes a huge difference and it helps new listeners to tune in. For more details about our show, including images mentioned in the episodes, please visit our website, artcuriouspodcast.com. We are also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Art Curious Pod. Check back in 2 weeks as we continue to explore the unexpected, the slightly odd, and the strangely wonderful in art history.